to begin with today, I'd like to just make a connection between the teachings of the Lankavatara Sutra and the Genjo Koan, as inspired by a question from Kathy at the end of last week. Do you remember?
when I asked you about squaring this teaching with something.
Yes,
with the Jogen's coming, the things coming forward.
Mm-hmm.
I asked it after class, by the way.
She asked about one of our classic Zen teachings of Dogen, Zenji, and the Genjo Koan. It says something like, to carry oneself forward, and literally it's practice and verify the myriad things is delusion. Our translation says, to carry the self forward and experience myriad things is a kind of abbreviation for that. But it's that phrase, practice and realization, Dogen uses all over the place, actually is in this case. It might seem kind of strange to say practice and verify there, but to carry oneself forward and practice myriad things, you could say, and verify myriad things, is delusion. That myriad things come forth and practice and verify oneself is realization. Or that myriad things come forth and experience themselves is awakening, is another translation. So I think Kathy maybe brought this up wondering, in this mind-only view where there's nothing out there, what about these myriad things that come forth and verify us? Isn't that a beautiful teaching, that it's not about us, it's about the world coming forward and making us what we are? Doesn't it seem like these mind-only teachings would do away with that whole wonderful teaching? She asked, and I thought, this is a good question to look at. and so, contemplating this, and, you know, you can take up something like this as a koan to contemplate. I contemplated for a while. And she also said something like, well, we don't have to match up all teachings. They don't have to all agree, do they? And I said something like, no, they don't have to, but in the realm of Buddha Dharma, it's nice to see if we can match up. And that's something that I very much enjoy doing, particularly, you know, trying to align the strange Zen teachings of Dogen with classical teachings of Indian Buddhism, for example, because I don't think he's just like come up with a whole new spiritual tradition. I think it's closely based on classical Dharma teachings of India, Mahayana teachings. So in this case, when considering it, I thought, it so perfectly matches up with mind only, and so wonderfully demonstrates the teaching that this is how I would understand it. Maybe the first part, the first phrase of Dogen about delusion is maybe not so hard to see how that actually does match up. Again, the phrase is to carry, I'm going to use the more literal translation here, to carry oneself forward to practice and verify the myriad things is delusion. That's the definition of delusion. So in our mind-only system, the self, the sense of self and view of self, this whole self issue seems to be all wrapped up in what we call manas, right? The seventh consciousness, if you remember that teaching about the seventh consciousness, manas, which is like the mental sense, not really sense, mental faculty, mind faculty, is, it doesn't say it explicitly in the sutra, but Vasubandhu says this manas is constantly afflicted by a view of self and confusion regarding the self and pride in self and attachment to self. So it's almost like the seventh consciousness is like the sense of self. You could almost say that tentatively for now. So in this system, in this eight consciousness system of mind-only tradition, so we could say, and remember, we have Alaya, the storehouse consciousness that contains everything. The eighth consciousness is the storehouse of everything, and all other seven consciousnesses and their objects and so on all arise like waves from the ocean of storehouse consciousness, right? So one of them that arises is manas, right? So this sense of self, of me, arises from this ocean of all inconceivable, you know, causality and karmic causes and effects. The self arises, and to think that this manas arises, and then we carry it forward. We bring our sense of self forward, outward into an apparently external world, and then we practice myriad things. You could say we like do myriad things in this world out here, and we verify myriad things. Which is like, we verify this as a floor, we verify that as a ceiling. Or we could also use the translation experience as a simpler thing. We carry the manas forward and experience the things of that so-called external world, but as we know now in this system, it's not really an external world. The myriad things are also waves in the ocean of Alaya. So we could almost picture an image of like there's this ocean and there's this one wave over here out of the ocean called manas, and then there's one wave over here of like the Zendo altar, and they're both just mind, and they're not separate at all because they're both part of the ocean. But the manas, if we carry it forward and experience the Zendo altar as in relation to me, oh, that's like an altar that I know. I relate to that altar. I make offerings at that altar. It's an altar of my consciousness. This is delusion. Can you kind of follow that? And even if you don't have if you don't go along with this mind-only view, it's a pretty similar principle to carry whatever we call the sense of self forward and experience a world out there as mine. My world is delusion, but mind-only quite clearly talks about it. I would say it defines delusion in very much the same way, to carry the sense of self as the seventh consciousness forward and have it contact these myriad objects that are not actually separate from itself at all. They're completely not separate. That's the main point in mind only, is that they're mind objects, they're projected objects. But to think that I'm verifying those out there is delusion. That might not be so hard to see how those match up, but I think the second line is the one that maybe is harder to see at first. The second line being the myriad things coming forth and practicing and verifying oneself. This is realization. Because we say, well, if it's all mind only, then where do these myriad things come forth from? How can we be awakened by the myriad things? Isn't it all just like myself again? If it's all just mine? But we make this distinction. We don't say mind only means me only. It's mind only. Mind is not me. Mind can give rise to me as the seventh consciousness. But mind is just our whole world of experience, actually free from a sense of self, until that sense of self arises out of it. So, to put it in one sentence, the first part I wrote is to project manas outward, to do things and verify things, or verify appearances, arising from alaya as me. That's delusion. That myriad things come forth and practice and verify oneself, being realization. I put it as to let the appearances arising from alaya as the world return to alaya, like waves settling back into the ocean, thereby being merely just alaya, or what we call mind only, and verifying alaya as we could call it the true selfless self, as oneself is realization. Now it's almost like two different meanings of self here, but I would say no matter how you read this Dogen phrase, before ever looking at it in mind only terms, I usually would read these two sentences of Dogen as like kind of two different versions of self. To carry the small self forward and experience the world is delusion, but the world coming forth and verifying or experiencing oneself is realization. I would say not the small self in this case, but actually verify one's true dependently arising self is realization. This is just outside the mind only world. Or I think that was a pretty creative interpretation of Kaz, Ta-Nehisi, and others to say that myriad things come forth and experience themselves. I think we could see it, it's kind of playing with it a little bit, because it's really like jiko in both versions, which just means self. But it's a nice little play there. It takes us out of the picture completely. It's just the world's just doing its thing and verifying itself. I have nothing to do with it. That's realization. But we can also see it as the world's coming forward and verifying our true self. So the world, in this case, the myriad things, is still the myriad things arising from alaya. And now we're going back to the mind-only interpretation of this line of Dogen. The myriad things is never myriad things out there. In the mind-only view, the myriad, so-called myriad things are the appearances or projections of mind as an external world. But those myriad things coming forth now, not carrying the manas forward and experiencing them, but just the myriad things arising as appearances without meifying them, without selfifying them, just the myriad appearances of alaya. We don't have to do anything to make them come up. As human beings, the mind projects an appearance of a world, and then to just let those waves sink back into alaya without reifying them as an external world, which is what the sutra talks about a lot, is the waves rise up and then they sink back into the storehouse, and then a new set of waves comes up and sinks back down. And so our practice then is to let the appearances arising from alaya just return back to alaya, like waves settling back into the ocean, and recognize them as merely appearances of mind. And actually we could even say those appearances verify our true self as like the alaya, the storehouse that's free from all reification. And with this sutra makes this connection that we haven't gotten into so much yet of Buddha nature, right? Tathagatagarbha is another name for like alaya, purified of all its delusions. And that we sometimes say, other sutras say, this Tathagatagarbha, this Buddha nature, is our true self. It's kind of a controversial topic, but they say it's the true Atman, which is this really kind of taboo word in Buddhism, because there is no true Atman. But in the Mahayana, there's like, for example, the Mahaparinirvana Sutra says, this Buddha nature is self. So if we put that into this equation, we could say the myriad things of Alaya coming forth and then just sinking back into Alaya without reifying them as a small attached self, then they verify the true self of Alaya just being Alaya. So I don't know if you could follow all of that, but for me it was a great contemplation to see how, oh yeah, it could completely align these teachings of Dogen with the mind only view. He probably didn't have that in mind exactly, but that all these teachings in the, you know, are not so contradictory. Doesn't mean that there aren't any contradictions in Dharma, because there are different schools. There's different traditions that debate with each other and argue and actually don't come to agreement, even within the Mahayana. And yet they're very, very similar also. So any questions about that Dogen part? I don't know if you could follow it all.
This is a question that is more of an underlying question, but it kind of is brought up again by thinking about the symptoms of Alaya. And I have no confidence that I'm going to be able to express what I'm trying to express, because it's kind of complicated. But all along, I've had a difficulty as I'm listening and processing and experiencing, you know, playing with this of who's mine, what, you know, and it's tied to self and self, you know, small, you know, sometimes we characterize small self and
whose mind is your question?
Yourself. And when, where I get kind of stuck, but I see maybe a direction here, is when we speak about Alaya, you know, arising and coming forth as the mind's moment, which is not Chris's moment, then it's hard to put that together with, but it's not really my mind that's the creator.
You're being who? Like a small self?
Yeah, me being a small self with a little, a light, pot of a light. Here's the way. My light pot makes a lot of sense. Stir it constantly.
You love that little pot.
Attached to that little pot of a light.
It's just that it's not your pot, and it's stirring itself. And part of, but it's a unique soup, you know. It's an it's a, you know, that particular pot of soup is karmically conditioned in a unique way, and there's a bunch of different pots that are all stirring themselves here. And then to say that it's my pot, that's a very natural tendency. That's what the teachings are actually saying, is that we can't help but think that, well, whose pot is it? It's a great question that you're asking, because that's our natural tendency, is like, well, it's my mind, right? It's my pot of soup, my karmic tendencies, my dispositions. But can we see it as, and this, I think this is an important teaching in all schools of Buddhism, not just mind only, but to see, can there just be this pot of stuff being stirred that has no owner?
And this is what I wanted to express, that the way it could make sense to me is, here's consciousness expressing itself in a moment as this expression of Chris's, that's Chris and her mind, if you will, that's this expression over there,
and this expression over here, and it's not separate, and yet there's a unique expression, but it's still like connected.
Yeah, it's connected, and we keep coming back to these questions. Is there one mind or many minds? And individual, unique karmic collections, but they're completely interdependent because we affect each other all the time. So they're kind of overlapping, and they have no location, right? So these pots don't really have borders. You might ask about the borders. It's like the soups are kind of mixing into each other and flavoring each other. And yet they're like, the center of the pot is like, you know, it doesn't just get all poured into one giant pot either. In this ultimate realm, I think I talked about it, like, ultimately there's not a bunch of different soups, but in that ultimate realm, it's not even like you pour all the soups into one and it's one collection of karmic tendencies. In the ultimate realm, it's like not even soup. And that's the realm where there's not separate minds at all. But there's not even mind at that point, we could say. And we could call that one mind in a Zen style. But does that make sense? This is a really important point that that there's these, and in a way the whole, maybe one of the purposes of teaching Alaya is that there's this sense of me and all my history, but it's not really a self there. It's not really my karmic tendencies. It's just the karmic tendencies. But as we can see, we have our unique set of karmic tendencies, our unique dispositions, and we affect each other, and they're constantly changing too. It's definitely not a fixed pot of soup. It's constantly being, flavors are being added, the temperature's being changed every moment.
So, if you were to try to take this back to the beginning, if we can call it that, when there was nothing in the pot, where would you say it started to, where was the first piece of something?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's like, we can come up with stories, but generally the Buddha like didn't go there because it's all just speculation. Like when we say in the morning, we say, all my ancient twisted karma from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion. We don't say like, all my ancient twisted karma that started at this certain point, and before that, it was just an empty pot. You know, it's, for all intents and purposes anyway, it's beginningless. Now, it's interesting for me to try to come up with stories about what happened before, you know, how did this whole thing start rolling? But, what's that?
The Big Bang.
The Big Mind Bang.
Sure. Well, that's the problem.
Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah. Even with the Big Bang, if we go into those stories, it's like we can't really go to the beginning, right? Because the mind starts to just... the mind can't get a hold when we start going back to beginnings.
Well, there's no time anyway, right?
That's right.
Ultimately, there's no time. But there does seem like there's been this evolution, and we could... we could go back somewhat in terms of like evolution of life on Earth and look at like primitive animals. Maybe we don't go back to like cells for the story, but we go back to like when living beings started to create karma, which was way before humans, right? And so you could say Alayas, these storehouses of karmic tendencies, were around a long time ago. and the sense of self, I think that's an interesting thing to look at. And probably biologists have come up with a certain point in evolution where a sense of self, at least stories about this, when a sense of self was born that could actually rise out of the storehouse and reflect on objects out there in relation to itself and say that it's mine, my food or my earth or whatever. And you can see it's a very natural, as we've talked about before, a good evolutionary trait to believe in duality. Good evolutionary trait for survival, for the survival of the individual, the fittest, but not so good for the survival of the species as a whole. So that's why evolution seems to have given rise to this, like, now these spiritual teachings with Buddha and so on, where there's now we got the duality thing down really well. We don't have to, like, completely stop doing that. We just have to start not believing in its reality as strongly. And we'll still survive. It looks like the Buddha didn't stop eating when he realized that the food was not external to his mind. He could still do that appearing thing called eating the food. You know, so and maybe good for survival of the individual in the end also. So, but we don't really know how it started. That's like the all these questions that people would ask the Buddha, and he said, you know, when the arrow is shot and stuck in you, do you ask, you know, like, where'd the arrow come from? And who shot it? Or do you just pull out the arrow and deal with the situation at hand? So although it's interesting, we know that we're in this situation now. Somehow we got into this very, very strange situation of being these, like, sentient beings that can, like, project the world and believe that there's somebody running the show inside here, in addition to this collection of karmic tendencies. And so this issue of self is, you know, from the very early, way before mind only, has been the issue. So of course that's that issue of the illusion of an independent self in addition to the five skandhas, you could say, was right there from the beginning. And this mind only has the same teaching. It just says it expands the five skandhas into eight consciousnesses and says five skandhas are all manifestations of this great storehouse ocean. That we also, just like we take five skandhas to be a self, we take the alaya to be a small individual independent self. Yeah, another, I recently heard some teaching too about, you know, we probably get the idea of this kind of thing by now, but it was just a nice way of expressing it, that it's like, when we have problems with the world and so on, it's like we're shadow boxing with ourselves, as the image, you know. When we get upset with others, it's always, really, we're just upset with our own projections of others. So, you know, this is probably through all schools of Buddhism also would agree with this, but mind only has this very specific way of and honing in on this point of, well, what do you mean projections? It goes really far with saying that everything is just projections of mind. So we're always just fighting with ourselves. We always have problems with ourselves, and we call it others because it's more fun. Yes.
One of the problems that I have with this, that I've had when you use the word mind and say everything is mind only, that's kind of like saying everything is what it is. Because mind, the way we think of mind, is when we see how our mind works, so which we see how the mind works that we're familiar with, let me put it that way, because it's not really our mind. So, but we see how the mind works that we're familiar with, and so naturally when we're taught that everything is a projection of mind only, the mind that we're familiar with thinks of that mind-only mind, this being, is having similar characteristics of the mind that we're familiar with.
Such as?
Small self. Such as will, for example, mm-hmm. and being able to make plans, and being able to control things, and so...
But that is all part of mind.
Mind, this mind-only, then starts to become pictured as a... as a God who's making things happen and creating us to experience ourselves for his own enjoyment. In other words, projecting our own mind that we're familiar with into this mind, this big mind only thing. But philosophically, if you say that everything is just a projection of mind, you're not really saying anything. You're using a word mind, the word mind, say it's a projection of, just because we have something that we've called mind, that we picture being in here sometimes, that can project things and we can understand it that way. But I disassociate any relationship between my idea or the mind that I'm familiar with, the way the word mind is used, as being like the mind-only mind that all things are projected from, that this mind that I'm familiar with experiences as separate things, separate from myself. Does that make sense?
Well, I don't know exactly what you're saying, but let's see if this helps, that we either think that it's my mind, or if it's not, then we have to project it into some larger thing, like it's a God controlling it or something. We want to put some
mind or the Tao.
Yeah, we want to project some external force that's running the show. It's our natural tendency, whether we call that me or God or the Tao or some mystical force. But mind only, the thing is, well, we could say there is something that's, you know, in a way controlling everything, but all that is just conditionality. It's just cause and effect. So that's the thing here. What is this Alaya storehouse consciousness? It's just the ocean of causality, a particularly karmic causality. It's like, I decide to pick up this paper now. It's not really that I decided to.
It just happened.
Well, it happened according to conditions, and particularly will, which is in the translation here of the seventh consciousness, that seems like a self, decides to pick up the paper. But that is a conditioned decision. It decides to then put it down, and that whole thing gets planted in the storehouse consciousness and creates a tendency to pick up the paper again. And now we have a habit of picking up papers. And so the whole thing is just... there's nobody doing it. It's just, it's cause and effect. And it's unique. Each so-called person has their own unique set of cause and effect habit patterns. And we're so, one of our conditioned things is this strong tendency to think that there must be somebody doing this. There must be somebody in charge.
I'm suggesting that calling it mind, people could infer from that mind is in charge.
Well, you could
and
say
that might be part of our problem of accepting the fact that the mind-only teachings could be are possible.
Well, we could say, in a way, mind is in charge, but what is mind?
Well, I'm saying, I'm saying that calling it mind begs the question of what is mind.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't answer it. And acceptance of what is as mind only is just circular. I mean, I don't have a problem with mind only. To not have a problem, I have to not think mind is having any characteristics whatsoever, this mind, that I associate from this mind's experience with what we call mind.
Well,
otherwise, I start going down conceptualizing once more.
Yeah, well, if you mean this mind-only view is different than the way we're normally experiencing the world. It's like, seems like there's me over here looking at a paper over here. And we think it must be completely different than that. But actually, that is an experience of the Alaya right now. And
I'm not saying that at all. No. I know it would be hard to explain. I'm suggesting that one of the problems of interpretation of mind only is simply the word mind that's used to say what it's only of. We could just say that it's just only suchness. Causes and conditions. So it's just causes and conditions. But Nagarjuna meant to show that there is no cause and effect either. So whenever concepts are used to explain ultimate reality, which is another concept, then you end up having to let go of every concept, your idea of what that concept is, because that's just another idea that's in the small mind, the experience that leads us down the path. Attachment.
You could almost say, like, why even bother saying mind if you just say it's just things as they are? Yeah, in a way you could say, and then it comes into like the view of Nagarjuna maybe, who doesn't bring up all this mind-only stuff, but he shows how everything is just what it is apart from our reification of it, maybe we could say. But he's not necessarily saying that, he's not emphasizing how it's all projections of mind. So this is just, it's kind of, this is emphasizing that little twist on it, saying, well, how did it all get here, the way that we're experiencing it?
And here we go again, spinning down conceptualization.
Yeah, well, we could say it all got here as projections of mind. Anyway, yes.
Coming up in this teaching that we're studying are verses that seem to speak to what you guys are talking about.
Maybe.
Sorry for okay.
It might be interesting to see how it relates to the issue that you guys are grappling.
The Bhagavan then repeated the meaning of this in verse.
What page is that?
75. The bottom of page 2 in this. Just like waves in a boundless sea blown by a powerful wind, breakers in a vast expanse never for a moment cease. So we've heard these images before. Now it's going to it's going to unpack the metaphor. In the ocean of Alaya, stirred by the wind of externality, and as I mentioned last time, externality here is a translation of Vishaya, which means like the objects of mind. On the chart of that we set up of the sense faculties, the sense consciousnesses, and the sense objects. The sense objects are called Vishaya, or field, the sense fields. So it's nothing is external in mind only, right? But we could say the appearances of external objects. In the ocean of Alaya, stirred by the wind of appearances of external objects, I think would be an accurate way of saying it, wave after wave of consciousness breaks and swells again. And I understand this to be the other seven consciousnesses. The sense consciousnesses, mental consciousness, and the sense of the self that we call the seventh consciousness. All of these are like waves arising and breaking and settling back into Alaya. Those are two really nice verses. Nice poetic verses kind of summing up the working of the eight consciousnesses, like waves in the ocean. Blue and red and every color, milk and sugar and conch shells, fragrances and fruits and flowers, the sun and moonlight. So, a list of colors, and as the note says, milk and sugar and conch shells are all white. So first it's talking about all the stuff that's all the waves emerging out of alaya that are the consciousnesses but also the objects of consciousness and so on are all emerging out of and settling back into the storehouse. So we have blue and red and every color, we make these distinctions, and then you could see there's these different things that are all white color, so the visual consciousness maybe can't distinguish them, but then you could say the conceptual consciousness can say, well, they all look white, but I know this one's a shell and this one's sugar. You know, I don't really know exactly where he's going with this. Or you could just say the subtle distinctions. But they're not like blue and red anymore. They're all white, but there's still differences here. Fragrances and fruits, so like the other senses of smell and tastes, and flowers, the sunlight and moonlight, you know, the distant things that are outside the earth even, all of this. Like the ocean and its waves are neither separate nor not separate. Seven forms of consciousness rise together with the mind. So hopefully this is somewhat clear now. This is summarizing these teachings. And important to see that the ocean, the eighth consciousness, the storehouse ocean, and the seven other consciousnesses arising from it are not separate or nor not separate. So, and this is why we say mind only, because if like the colors that arose from mind were actually separate from the storehouse, then mind and object would be separate. And we have a duality, whereas mind only, they're all means everything is of the nature of mind. So there's actually, it's all mind. It's mind only. Mean is the part about they're not separate. And yet, they're not just like, we don't just say it's all just one thing. We can make these distinctions. And that's why the metaphor of ocean and waves is such a great simile or metaphor, because an ocean and waves, they're not exactly the same, but they're not at all separate. The waves are manifestations of the ocean. The appearances of the Zendo are manifestations of the storehouse. Like the ever-changing sea gives rise to different waves, repository or storehouse consciousness gives rise to different forms. So forms here is this term lakshana, which is not really forms. It's like characteristics or marks or appearances, I think we could even say. And that makes more sense to me, that the storehouse gives rise to these different appearances, right, of the world, such as color and sound and smell and the seven consciousnesses. Mind, will, and consciousness. So that's mind in this sutra refers to alaya. Sometimes it's called just citta, or mind. Will is manas, the seventh. And consciousness is the sixth consciousness. Conceptual, mental consciousness. Mind, will, and consciousness. These refer to different appearances, lakshana, but appearances devoid of differences, no seer or thing seen. As the ocean and its waves cannot be divided, the minds and the appearances of consciousness cannot be separated. So that's a really important statement, that the appearances of consciousness are not separate from the mind. That's non-duality, mind only. The mind, in this case, alaya, is what gathers karma. This is a nice verse here, summarizing the functions of the different aspects here. So the eighth consciousness, mind, is what gathers karma, right? It's the storehouse that's gathering in all the actions, karmic activity we do, body, speech, and mind, plants a seed in alaya. Remember that story? So it's gathering in all karmic activities of this body and mind, of this body, speech, and mind. Not my body, speech, and mind, if we try to be accurate with language, but this particular body, speech, and mind is constantly creating karma means intentional activity, and the storehouse is gathering it all in. The will, or the manas, that's afflicted with the sense of self, considers what is gathered. A nice little summary, right? So that's just like this image we had before. Storehouse is just gathering in the karma. Then there's me that considers, oh, I just said something. You know, I wonder if it was good or bad. Good karma or bad karma. It's like the self, the sense of self that's considering, basically assessing and judging all our own actions. You could even say judging ourself. The will considers. It's kind of funny to say will in this case. Will is, I think, a very loose translation of manas that Red Pine likes to use. The storehouse gathers the karma. This manas considers what's gathered. And then the other forms of consciousness are conscious of five apparent worlds. So we could say the five sense consciousness are conscious of five apparent worlds of color, sound, smell, taste, touch. And where's the sixth in here? Well, it doesn't really say how many here. It just is, you could say I would interpret it as the other six forms of consciousness are conscious of five apparent worlds. So the sixth consciousness makes a conceptual version of the sense experience. It's like we see a brown floor, and then the sixth consciousness says, I see a brown floor, based on the sensory experience. So that's a little one-verse summary you could memorize. One verse that very briefly defines the functions of all eight consciousnesses. Does that make sense? It hasn't said this in the sutra quite so succinctly before. The alaya gathers karma. The will, or the seventh consciousness, considers what is gathered, like, and kind of separates it to consider it.
Observes,
yeah, but kind of like as an external thing, like, ooh, I just did that action. Maybe, like, problem. Considers it, or like, I just did that action. How great. And that's the self, thinks it's constantly either good or bad. It's doing good or bad. That's the self. And the other forms of consciousness are just doing their thing with the five sensory worlds. Mahamati Bodhisattva then asked in verse, when colors such as blue and red appear in someone's consciousness, and every thought is like a wave, what does all this mean? Like, what are you talking about? Maybe he's asking, what is like the deep inner meaning here? Because this seems like how the Buddha is answering it. The Buddha just puts another twist on this. The Bhagavan then replied in verse, blue and red and other colors can't actually be found in any wave. Like, in other words, these so-called colors and sounds and stuff are actually mental projections, right? They can't really be found in these waves of consciousness. There aren't colors out there. So I'd say that's like one sentence that's kind of answering his question, one little phrase. But then he goes on and kind of changes the topic a little bit. We say the mind gathers karma to awaken foolish beings. So I understand this gets kind of strange here. I hear it as a little quotation mark. We say, quote, the mind gathers karma, unquote, to awaken foolish beings. Mm-hmm. Right.
This might be a quick question. Every time you've said mind, you want us to think of a liar?
Yeah, in this case.
And maybe the rest of our lives, or whatever that said. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm trying that on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And to remember.
In some way.
Yeah. Isn't it?
Think about it. It's just up here.
Yeah. Mind is the storehouse of, and it includes, there are other consciousnesses that we could call aspects of mind, like a visual perception is part of mind, but that's in Alaya. So we really can say, or in Alaya, or emerges out of Alaya.
I'm thinking this is going exactly where I was thinking.
Oh, good.
This is like the punchline. You've got to let go of the teachings.
Oh yeah, that's coming up. That's coming up too, yeah.
This is the beginning.
But I think we can say that mind is equated with Alaya here. And so therefore when we say the mind only school, it's fair to say it's the Alaya only school. We can say that.
That's yeah. Okay. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
About something non-precise and then mixing metaphors. Yeah. But I'm thinking about manas and alaya as manas being a part and arising in alaya.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about our bodies and the world as in a way exactly the same. Because we, in with manas, we grab certain particles and they say, oh, this is now my mind.
Yeah.
It's very pretty, I like it.
I think I see what you're saying, yeah.
And the same thing is with my body, the water in my blood has been around forever.
Yeah.
And it's passing through
me. Yeah.
And in 7 years, none of this will be here. It's all going to be gone, but I will continue to talk about my body like it's something fixed.
Yeah.
But it's arising out of the world just the same as.
Yeah, I think we could make that analogy that physically, we're just talking physically now, there's a physical world, and then there's with all these different elements and different plants and animals and minerals, and then one particular collection of physical stuff forms this body, and it's just part of the rest of the world. There's no, why do we make a division between this body and this cushion, but the cushion and the floor, we're not so concerned with that distinction, right? But this distinction, we're really concerned. So that's an illusory thing. We think my body is like a separate thing in the world, just like manas is like a part of the big mind, but it kind of splits itself off and thinks of itself as a separate self. Sometimes we put it like that, that manas is like the sense of the self separate from Alaya, but sometimes it's said as, and the way, if you remember this chart that we set up here, it's like the manas actually is looking at all the stuff of Alaya and saying that that's a self. It's more like the projector of a self rather than thinking itself is a self. It's just the projector that then says, that maybe actually looks down at the body and says, this is myself. This body over here is me, or this karmic tendency that's arising from Alaya, like the habit to pick up the paper. Oh, that's my habit. That's, you know, that's me. That's part of, that's kind of who I am, is the guy who picks up the paper. So, yeah, a great connection, I think. Did people follow that?
It's going to be verified by Buddha in the verse in 12.
Okay, so.
keeping it moving.
Blue and red and other colors can't be found anyway. We say the mind gathers karma, unquote, in order to awaken foolish beings. That's, in other words, that's what we're going to see here. This is kind of a provisional teaching. The Buddha just said the mind is what gathers karma, but now he says, we actually just say that to awaken foolish beings. It's kind of, the mind doesn't really gather karma. So this is a new little twist here, too.
That makes it sound like the mind actually has will and is gathering karma.
Well, here it says the will is what considers it.
Well, I know that. I mean, I'm saying it's making it sound, that phrase, it's now saying, that phrase, the mind gathers karma.
Maybe that's a problem with the phrase.
Yeah.
Yeah. You could interpret it as the mind is intentionally gathering it somehow, or the mind has a self. Yeah. I'd say let's just interpret this gathering thing as the function of mind is just to gather. There's nobody doing it. It's just it's the activity of the mind is the activity of gathering karma. But again, our tendency is to keep thinking there must be somebody doing it. There must be a subject.
We're projecting our false sense of self.
We constantly do.
The
desperate need
for a subject. Yeah. Yeah. Where there's just activity happening, and very unique karmic activity that really makes it seem as if it's mine. It's just, you know, it's really worth contemplating very deeply this point. This is where this whole teaching about self. Who's doing this? All of this. So, let's see. Where are we?
11.
But karma isn't real. Woohoo. And we could say, in parentheses, it is just mind or mental projection. We mentally project. Karma means into activity of body, speech, and mind. So like, blah, 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 blah. Are these really words coming out? And we say they're not really... the fact that I even think that they're words is a mental projection. And that they're having an effect, all of that is a mental projection. And even in the early teachings of Buddhism, the Buddha said, karma is a really important teaching. It's called the conventional truth, and you can't neglect it. But it's not the ultimate truth. Ultimately, there isn't karma, even in the Pali Canon. But we can't skip over the fact that we think that we're doing stuff because then, there's no karma. Just whatever. Whatever goes. So karma isn't real, ultimately. This is the inner meaning here. Thus, to make their minds let go, I would say, of what grasps and what is grasped, I liken it to waves. Their body, possessions, and the world, this is what they're conscious of. And I think this is a nice summary of the objects from kind of like close to far. The objects of that are mine. There's my body. Then there's my possessions, like my house and my car and stuff. And then there's my world. Not like I own the world, but it's my world, right? It's
so,
like,
so this is a description of monas.
Or foolish beings. Right, if you could say, maybe referring back to, I teach this to awaken foolish beings to make their minds let go. I liken it to waves. What you mean, their body, possessions, in the world? You could say foolish beings, but technically speaking, manas is manas is like the foolish being, the kind of central headquarters of the foolish being is the seventh consciousness that's like, you know, me. I'm good. I'm bad. I'm doing it all. I'm not doing it. Like a little to the left, a little to the right. Yeah. This is my body, these are my possessions, and this is my world. Isn't it, you know, again, these are like so many contemplations here to really like take home and take up. It's like when you get into your car, you know, the rules of the land say, like, you paid money for the car, it's your car. But we really feel as if, like, don't we feel like there's a me here, and it's really like, is my car. I mean, don't we feel it very deeply? So if somebody comes up and, like, not even, like, damages it, but even, like, kicks it, we feel a little bit hurt. Ooh, don't kick my car. We identify with our possessions as kind of like an extension of myself and even my world. So that, like, how can you do that to my world? You're polluting my river, you know? I'm personally offended. Not like I as part of the world am offended, but my little me is like offended because that's, and don't we feel like it's, you know, when it's closer to home, when it's the Santa Cruz River, we feel much more offended than the African River being polluted. So it's kind of like small, you know, close to far, body, possessions, and world, I think is a nice little meditation on the objects we're aware of. Their body, possessions in the world, this is what they're conscious of. This is how their karma appears, just like surging waves. And here I would interpret this is how their karmic effects of past karmic actions, such as the thought, this is my body, is a karmic action, and that the effect of that karmic action appears as the illusion of my body. Does that make sense? It's kind of like shorthand to say this is how their karma appears as body possessions in the world. We might wonder, what's the mechanism there? How does karma appear as a body? But if we say it's the effect of karma, of thinking thousands and thousands of millions of times before, looking down here and saying, this is my body, that's a karmic action to think that. That karmic action produces the effect of, like, that immediately it appears that way again as my body and my world. Does that make sense?
Well, except that it just said that karma doesn't
exist. Yeah, this whole story is an illusory story. But there isn't really my body and my possessions in the world either, but in this world where those things appear, they appear due to karma. So this whole element of karma is being brought in here for the first time in these verses now. That this whole, and maybe this goes back to Jeff's question, how did it all start? And as we chant in the morning, beginning our ancient twisted karma, you could say set the whole thing rolling. You know, there first has to be a sense of a self, and then that self that thinks it's doing things, that's basically inevitably producing 24-hour karmic effects. And that, and the unique way that it's doing that for each of us is our unique storehouse. This is how their karma or karmic effects appear like surging waves. Mahamati Bodhisattva then asked in verse, the ocean and its waves exist. We can see them dance. And I think he's referring to the actual, like, Pacific Ocean. Like, not the metaphor. Like, the ocean over there and its waves exist. We can see them dance. Why then are we not aware of alaya consciousness and karma? So he's saying, like, in this metaphor you say it's like an ocean and waves, but actually this whole process is like, we can't just see it like we can go down to the ocean and watch it happen. It's much more subtle than that, right? This is why we've been just trapped by it for countless eons, because it's pretty hard to see how it all works. Why then are we not aware of this storehouse consciousness and karma? The Bhagavan then replied in verse, for fools bereft of wisdom, alaya is likened to an ocean and karma to its waves. Through simile they understand. In other words, this simile or metaphor, that's all it is, and it's, you know, it's a kind of rough thing, really, that it doesn't do it. It's kind of nice as far as similes go, but if you grasp the simile, if you say it's just exactly like the waves and water, this is a skillful means to try to present something that's very subtle, actually. So for fools bereft of wisdom, I use metaphors and similes like this.
Such as we.
Mahamati then said in verse, sunlight shines the same on beings of all classes, since Tathagatas light the world to teach the truth to fools. Which is a great teaching. Buddha's sun shines in everything. The Buddha's teaching equally teaches all beings in this inconceivable way. So then he goes on to say, versed in every kind of teaching, why don't they teach the truth? I would say, instead of mere similes. That's how I understand this. She says, look at the ocean and the waves. I see them. Why don't I see this stuff that you're talking about? And the Buddha says, it's just a simile. It's very subtle here. You're going to have to contemplate this really deeply here. And then Mahamati says, well, why don't you just give it to us straight? Why don't you teach the truth, Buddha, instead of these, like, teaching for fools, these metaphorical teachings for fools? To which the Buddha then replied in verse, if they taught the truth, in beings' minds would be no truth. So if the Buddha's really taught the truth directly, apart from similes and metaphors, it's actually no truth. The bottom line is, just like there's no karma, there's no truth, there's actually nothing can be, the truth can't be spoken in words, right? This is, we know in Zen, a major theme. So we give these metaphors and similes as skillful means to help us understand how this, these, how the appearances work. But if its target is taught the truth in being's mind, there would be no truth. Like the ocean and its waves, a dream, or I would say a dreamer and a dream, we have these sets, an image and a mirror, both appear together, as do the mind and objective realms. So these are the metaphors he likes. And they're very useful, similes and metaphors. The ocean and its waves is one. And they're all about the storehouse and then the appearing world of externality. Ocean and waves. A dreamer is like the mind, and then the dream is a projection that seems very real. So again, dreamer and dream is kind of like alaya and the projections of consciousness. And then the image in a mirror, you could say the mirror is like the storehouse consciousness, and it's projecting these images. These images are projected on the mirror. And all those, just like the Buddha said, they're not the same or different. The ocean and the waves, the dreamer and the dream are not exactly the same or different. And the images in the mirror, they're not exactly the same, but they're like not really different either. So I think really three really great similes, even though they're just teaching for fools like us. But objective realms are never perfect, and karma keeps arising. While consciousness is conscious, likewise the will just wills. Maybe this goes back to Rich's thing too. There's like, there's nobody doing it. The will just wills. Consciousness is just conscious, and karma just keeps being produced. And the appearing objective realms are, we're never going to work them out. We're never going to have a perfect world because it's just karmic projections. And fivefold are appearances, except in meditation. You could say where certain kinds of meditation where the senses are not operating. Even if you close your eyes in meditation, the world of color does not appear. And you can, certain kinds of meditation, not like Zen meditation where we actually leave our senses open, but there are meditations where you can shut down all five senses. And therefore, there wouldn't be fivefold appearances. As a master artist works, and the master's students draw forms and spread colors. So I interpret this as the master artist is the Buddha, and the works that the Buddha does is teaching with words. So if you picture it like that, the master artist Buddha is like creating these paintings with words, and the master students, the bodhisattvas, draw forms and spread colors in all these treatises and Shobogenzo fascicles and so on. I too teach like this, but actually the colors, you know, the words of these treatises, don't contain a pattern of reality, you could say, nor do the brush or the pristine surface. To please the host of beings, they render figures with their art, but teachings are unfaithful, for truth isn't in the words. The Buddha's creating all this, the Lankavatara Sutra, and we're creating all these discussions about it. And it's quite creative, isn't it? It's like art. And it's helpful, but ultimately, he's speaking now, ultimately, the truth isn't in the words. Or we say in the dual mirror samadhi, the meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to an inquiring impulse. And the dual mirror samadhi has, this is one of the chants that we do in the morning, by Dongshan, a Zen teaching. There are several points in there about the words aren't it, but yet they can express it. Yet it is, there's another line there about words. Does anyone remember? It's not apart from words. Yeah, that's the same point too. Baba wa wise. Yeah. The meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. So there's some, the jewel mirror samadhi, you could say, which is like Buddha's wisdom, is not in the words of Dongshan's poem, but the jewel mirror samadhi responds to our impulse, our inquiring impulse that wants to understand it and wants to like discover it through the words. We have words and we use words. The meaning's not in them, but the words point. And this is a theme of this sutra too. To please the host of beings, they render figures with their art, but teachings are unfaithful, for truth isn't in the words. Yes, Jean?
A moment ago you said something like that the words can express it, but it actually, I think, is more like the words can't express it, really, but it can stimulate in the hearer of the words an experience of it for themselves.
Yeah. The words almost like the catalyst for the wisdom in the one who's reading the words. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Does anyone have a Passa Sutra book from under there? Sir? There's one other line in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi about near the beginning. Well, it does say, just to depict it in literary form is to stain it with defilement. It's kind of the same point. To depict this jewel mirror samadhi in words is staining it. Here in the jewel mirror samadhi it says, although it is not fabricated, it is not without speech. So the jewel mirror samadhi is not without speech. In here, and often in Zen, it's we wake up through words. Words are our source.
It just, in listening, it's like it seems as a way of listening, and then listening without creating more concepts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like building concepts on the words, or just I think with the idea of getting experience from the words versus building more concepts about what the words are saying.
Sometimes we do build concepts. I mean, if it was not about building concepts at all, we wouldn't have a class like this, right? Where we're actually trying to actually build more concepts in a way. But in the end, it's about like building the structure of concepts to the point where you see what's happening is actually that none of the concepts hold up. So they're like, they're teachings that are like, that are self-destructing, they're self-disintegrating. And sometimes we have to like really build them up a lot to get to that point because we're so into concepts. It's like, I think if we just say, just forget all concepts right now. I mean, sometimes maybe in Zazen we can do that, but if it were that simple, there wouldn't be like, wouldn't be all this dharma in words all over the place. There'd just be one sentence. It's just like, stop all concepts. And then, you know, if it was that simple, then the Buddha wouldn't have taught this Lankavatara Sutra, right? So it's kind of like concepts that are showing how concepts aren't reliable. And they're showing it in a more and more clear way. But it's true that in the end, it's like the dissolving of all concepts. Or sometimes I like to think of it as, at least there's a stage where it's not about, it's the concepts are continuing, but we really see that they're just merely concepts. And therefore, we don't stop projecting a world, but we just see that it's a mere projection. And then we can play with concepts. And I think this is Zen koans and all that about like being free from words and then being able to come forth and use words in this creative and strange new way because we're not caught by it. Well, that doesn't make sense. What do you mean a dog doesn't have Buddha nature? You can't say that all beings have Buddha nature. Jiaozhou said no. So, because he was free of these concepts of yes and no. To please the host of beings, they render figures with their art, but teachings are unfaithful, for truth isn't in the words. I make distinctions for beginners. We could say this is this point too, is like beginners is like everyone up to just before a Buddha maybe. For practitioners, I teach the truth. Maybe we could say when we're completely ready, the Buddha teaches the ultimate truth, that is no concepts. The truth they realize themselves, I would say, is free from knowing and the known. So ultimately this truth that realized by oneself is free from the duality of knowing and known. But if we hear that right away, we don't get that import of it. This I teach the bodhisattvas, a broader view to fools. All manner of illusions, but nothing I reveal is real. Thus my teachings are diverse, tailored to the situation. If a teaching doesn't fit, then it isn't taught. There's skillful means to each being needs to hear what they need to hear. Because each patient differs, good physicians adjust their cures. Buddhas thus teach beings according to their capacities. A realm without projections. Nirvikalpa or avikalpa. Unknown to shravakas. This is what the compassionate teach, the realm of inner realization. And finally, the concluding section here is just the summary of all that, a kind of spur towards practice, you could say. Moreover, Mahamati, if bodhisattvas wish to understand the realm of projection in which what grasps and what is grasped are nothing but perceptions of their own minds, then he gives some practical instructions. They should avoid social intercourse and sleep and cultivate the discipline of mindfulness during the three periods of the night. Interesting, right? Instead of saying, giving more technical instructions, he's like, now stop talking, stop socializing and stop sleeping and practice mindfulness all night. And they should avoid mistaken teachings and texts as well as the characteristics of the Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddha paths that don't get into these subtleties, and become versed instead in the characteristics of the projections that are projections of their own minds. Study delusion and these subtle projections of one's own mind. And does this have any resonance for people? What do you think of when you hear about giving up social intercourse and sleep? I think of Sashin. That's the time, you know, we don't give up talking all the time and give up much sleep. But in Sashin, we put all that aside, right? We have one coming up to just become familiar, become versed in the characteristics of the projections that are projections of their own minds. So for 5 days, you can come and just become really intimate with how the mind projects. I think that is one way to look at Sashin, right? And it's horribly torturous sometimes to see those projections. But with these kinds of teachings, it may be that we're in the bottom of some dark hell realm we've created, and we suddenly notice, oh wait, this mind just created Sashin hell realm. Sashin's a good place to create hell realms. And like, wait a second. That just happened from I kind of see, can trace how it happened from these karmic influences of Alaya now. It can seem more real, I think, when we stop talking and, you know, all the usual distractions that we engage in, that almost like just keep the thing rolling, but keep it kind of pleasant to pare it down to the basics and just don't move. Then it's like, whoa, can we get out of here? So we have one more class next week before Sashin. Or maybe do that last paragraph. May all beings become well-versed in the projections of their own minds, thus becoming free from them. Live at ease and let compassion arise for all beings. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become.